WMAL News at 7. Good morning. I'm Heather Curtis. Fairfax County Police now know the identity of two women found in a shopping cart in the woods last month. Chief Kevin Davis.
DNA evidence has confirmed the identities of Cheyenne Brown, 29 years old, of Washington, D.C., and Stephanie Harrison, 48 years old, of Redding, California, as the victims found in a container near the Moon Inn Motel in Alexandria.
They think 35-year-old Anthony Eugene Robinson, dubbed the shopping cart killer, did it. The chief says Robinson was the last person to be seen alive with Cheyenne. Robinson's in jail in Rockingham County, awaiting trial for the murders of two other women in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Teachers in Montgomery County Public Schools not happy about a change in when schools will switch to all virtual learning. Interim Superintendent Dr. Monifa McKnight says MCPS will no longer have kids do Zoom school if at least 5% of students and employees test positive for COVID. Instead, they'll look at each school individually before making that call. The guidance does not recommend any threshold for suspension of in-person learning. Montgomery County Education Association President Jennifer Martin.
What's needed is a greater clarity about what the metrics will be.
She says teachers also want more COVID testing done to keep employees and students safe. If the CDC's quarantine policy confused you, you're not alone. Now the agency's trying to clarify.
CDC Director Rochelle Walensky says her agency's new protocol for isolating after testing positive for COVID is that if one is symptom-free 5 days after testing positive, they can end isolation on day six.
As this virus changes, the science changes. And through it all, the scientists across CDC have worked every day to stay current in our recommendations.
Walensky admits the policy changes have been less than clear. CDC this week also agreed to reduce the wait for either Pfizer or Moderna booster shots from 6 to 5 months. Eben Brown, Fox News.
Some drivers were stuck on I-95 in Virginia overnight during Monday's storm. With more cold in the forecast this weekend and a chance for freezing rain tomorrow, will you be prepared if you get stuck now or during another storm this winter?
You may just run out, think you're running out to the store, and there's a crash along your route, and next thing you know, you're delayed for 2 hours.
Regina Ali with AAA is a big backer of keeping an emergency kit in your car, not just food and blankets to keep you going if you're stuck in an I-95 style debacle.
Definitely also want to make sure you have a charger for your phone, an ice scraper, snow brush. Those are definitely the essentials, a flashlight with extra batteries.
Why all this stuff?
Many people just don't think they're going to ever need it.
Until you do. John Matthews on WMAL and WMAL.com.
WMAL Sports, the Wizards lost to the Bulls 130-122. The Caps fell to the Blues 5-1. The Washington football team plays its final game tomorrow against the Giants. Airtime on WMAL is noon. Traffic and weather next. WMAL traffic, here's LBD in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
On the Maryland side of the Beltway, no delays in Prince George's County or in Montgomery County. If you're traveling between the two beltways, either on the BW Parkway or on 95 between Baltimore and D.C., you're not going to hit your brakes. Lanes are clear northbound and southbound. In Montgomery County on 270 between the Beltway and Frederick, no problems on the northbound side or on the southbound side. And in Prince George's County on Route 50 between the Beltway and Annapolis, on the eastbound side, there is a crash right at the Lotsford Vista Road overpass. No reports of any delays. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Storm Watch 7 forecast.
Sunny and cold start to the weekend with high temperatures into the lower 30s. Later on tonight, clouds beyond the increase, low temperatures in the lower 30s. Precipitation will begin early Sunday morning ahead of a cold front. A winter weather advisory has been issued from 6 o'clock in the morning through noon, areas north and west of town. We will have the chance for some freezing rain. We will see temperatures warm up into the afternoon into the low and mid-40s. Periods of rain, though, will continue to be likely. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Ligon, the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
24 degrees in Washington. I'm Heather Curtis on WMAL.
Now, from the WMAL WinBet Studios, the Saturday morning update.
Is hour two of the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. John Gizzi joins us, White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com and Newsmax TV. John, good morning.
Good morning.
The administration and Democrats commemorating the anniversary of the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol this week. The president and the vice president both addressing the nation from the White House. John, often we measure a president or the administration by the way they meet the moment. This was a unique moment that the president addressed, but when you look back over some of the critical moments in history, how would you say the president fared in relation to his predecessors?
I'll give him a D+, and that's a generous rating. Look, you talk about presidents meeting the moment. From Bill Clinton after the death of Prime Minister Rabin of Israel, when he said, "Shalom, friend," and touched the hearts of people in two nations, to George W. Bush's speech, fearlessly facing down an unknown and unseen enemy after the 9/11 attack, and now coming to a point where the president unleashes what even his strongest defenders would agree is a partisan attack on his predecessor. Whatever happened on January 6th, whomever perpetrated events that hurt people, whatever degree it was, and again, there's dispute on all of this. This was not a moment for pointing fingers. But the president, albeit never using the name of his predecessor, launched into an attack that was inarguably meant to rally his base. The former president of the United States of America has created and spread a web of lies about the 2020 election. He values power over principle because he sees his own interest as more important than his country's interest and America's interest. He also made some remarks about the president's bruised ego. Again, not to take sides, but this was a personalized salvo by one president against his predecessor. At a time when America came perhaps the closest to actually being divided since the Civil War, the early 1930s, and after a fractious presidential election, Franklin Delano Roosevelt never went on the attack against his unpopular predecessor, Herbert Hoover. He looked forward and was positive. And again, Donald Trump takes a lot of abuse for not being a positive influence and giving dark speeches, as people described his inaugural address. Well, this was a dark speech by his successor, and it's not going to help ease any partisan differences.
Well, speaking of partisan differences, Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema have certainly been at odds with their Democratic colleagues. So Joe Manchin gets a call from Michelle Obama and also gets a call from Oprah Winfrey. Do you think that will have any impact on swaying Joe Manchin and his vote for the voting rights legislation?
The last time I checked, neither the former First Lady, Michelle Obama, nor Oprah live in West Virginia. That's who the calls and the public statements really matter for Joe Manchin. Let's put it on the table. He has put his political neck out, invited rancor from his own party, an almost steady drumbeat of invective against him. And yet at home, his popularity ratings are over 65. Why? Because he looks at issues carefully, analyzes them, and will vote a certain way, whether it's popular or not. But it always seems to resonate with the men and women of the Mountaineer State. Now, you're talking about the voting rights legislation, the John Lewis Act in the House of Representatives. This, among other things, mandates a 15-day early voting period and the idea of counting and recording votes will come under national statutes rather than those of the individual states. This is a clear strike against local authority over elections, and that's why every Republican, including the four senators who are retiring this year, are voting no. And remember, those senators have no political risk in doing what they're doing. Manchin and Sinema, two senators who have stood out cast pivotal votes in the evenly divided Senate, have not yet changed their mind. And just as it is in West Virginia, I doubt that a call from those two non-Arizonans you mentioned is going to sway Senator Sinema.
Seems that over the past several administrations, much of the policy, much of the legislative agenda ends up at the Supreme Court. And this week we saw the question of vaccine mandates make it all the way up to the Supreme Court. Historically, has the Supreme Court gotten this much into political issues?
In the 1960s, it got involved in a variety of areas under Chief Justice Earl Warren. The so-called Warren Court dealt with various criminal cases, establishing the Miranda decision, saying that defendants have to be informed of their rights when arrested, to the redistricting of congressional and legislative districts along the lines of one man and one vote, and then more recently, of course, in whether the states can determine the legal status of abortion. I would say they've gotten involved with quite a bit, but the only reason it seems to be more than usual is because a lot of things are just coming to the docket of the Supreme Court now. One of these is whether or not mandates to require vaccinations are indeed legal and constitutional. In the case of Biden versus Missouri, that says it all. A district court stayed federal requirements for vaccination, and the court is going to decide whether this is constitutional or not. The president, of course, has weighed in, saying it's about public health, not about freedom. Attorney General Eric Schmidt welcomes the opportunity to present the opposite side of the case, which is that the states cannot be ordered and that people do have individual reasons for not being vaccinated. This reporter doesn't take sides on it, Rick. But he also notes that there are three related cases to this before the court, one in Louisiana and one in Ohio. And whenever the court decides, which is usually later rather than sooner, it's going to resonate on the twin issues of health care and freedom.
So it's been a week or two since President Biden and President Putin of Russia spoke about Ukraine. And is this a test of our foreign policy?
Soon after the call with President Putin, President Biden reached Mr. Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, and assured him that the United States would not stand by if an attack were launched against his country. Now, again, just like our continued statements of standing up for Taiwan were it to be attacked by China, these are nebulous words. He never says whether we'll send troops or air power or what we will do with Russia, including Magnitsky sanctions or those targeted at individuals to bar them from financial transactions or travel abroad. As we speak this morning, Rick, 175,000 Russian troops are amassed on the periphery of Ukraine. They could go in any minute. Or President Putin could launch an attack through cyberspace, possibly crippling the grid in Ukraine and subjecting that country to a very long, cold winter. There's also the possibility that Russian-speaking Ukrainians can have a, quote, spontaneous revolution, unquote, and the Russians will go in to defend them. Putin used this same move in Georgia when he said he was defending the freedom fighters of this province of Osetia. So there's a lot that could happen. 2 weeks from now, January 13th, representatives of the two presidents will meet for a Geneva summit and try to hammer out details. When one lifeline crosses another lifeline, the result is a noose for world peace.
John Gizzi, White House correspondent, chief political columnist, Newsmax.com and Newsmax TV. John, thank you as always, and you can follow John on Twitter at John Gizzi.
Stay warm and look for a nice photograph taken by my colleague at the White House, James Rosen of Newsmax, and me in some gracious words. You can see it on Twitter.
All right, 7:19. It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. Coming up next, we'll talk with Cheryl Atkinson, then we'll be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. KT McFarland is traveling this weekend, so Dr. Bob Lajito will fill us in on the very latest of the mutations of the coronavirus. No, it is not the Omicron variant. There is yet another one. Should you be worried about it or not? Well, we'll have Dr. Bob Lahita put it in perspective for us coming up between now and 8 o'clock. But right now, Al BD's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
Good morning. In Virginia on the Beltway, just checked out the traffic cameras. All lanes are clear, both on the inner loop and on the outer loop. On 66 in Fairfax County, no delays are reported eastbound or westbound. On 95 in Virginia, between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, you're at speed, both northbound and southbound. In the district, I have no reports of any crashes or construction on 295, 395, or on 695. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Sunny skies and cold temperatures expected on this Saturday. Highs should reach the lower 30s across the region, but with the full sunshine, we will still expect a bit of melt. As we head overnight, partly cloudy, lows back into the 20s in the suburbs, lower 30s around town. For your Sunday, an area of low pressure and a cold front will move into the region, bringing with it some precipitation. Ahead of it, with the cold air, we will have the chance for some freezing rain. In fact, a winter weather advisory is in effect from 6 o'clock in the morning through noon, areas north and west of D.C. We will see temperatures moderate through the afternoon into the low and mid-40s. We'll have periods of rain continue through Sunday evening. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
21 degrees in the nation's capital, 721 on the Saturday morning update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It's the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler, and a happy new year to Cheryl Atkison. She joins us after a little hiatus over the holidays. Cheryl, wonderful to have you back with us.
Happy 2022.
We all saw the news coverage of the anniversary of the January 6th riot at the Capitol, and you posted a very interesting perspective on all of this at CherylAtkison.com, and I must point out that you've authored several books on the media and the slant of the media, and as you looked at the coverage this week, what struck you?
Well, we've fallen short in so many areas, but the point of this was to look at if we had a generally neutral press, at least one more neutral like we used to have, how would January 6th have been covered differently? And I think there's three key differences from the death of Ashley Babbitt. The only homicide that day, according to officials, was committed by a Capitol police officer of an unarmed woman. And he is black, she was white, and this was not treated the way normal black-white police shooting of an unarmed suspect has been treated in the press. And there was a lot of secrecy surrounding the investigation, questions that weren't asked. I think number two, the notion of how peaceful the rally was that day before the violence at the end has escaped the media reporting. If we were a mostly neutral press, we'd be very careful not to blend the whole day up into what happened at the end by a relative few number of the crowd. We'd pay more attention to the point of the rally, which I think Trump's enemies did not want people to do. They didn't want the focus on the so many people that came out that day who believe that there had been voter fraud and were supporting President Trump and set all of this peacefully. And I think we'd have had a lot more focus on the voter fraud allegations. The press continues to say almost universally there was no widespread voter fraud that would have made a difference, when nobody that I've seen who said that has done any personal investigation of it. They're sort of parroting what others have said or what people want to be said in the media, despite a lot of evidence of some fraud and some irregularities and a lot of unanswered questions. So I guess I'm just sort of looking at January 6th, pre-2016 and pre-Donald Trump.
You mentioned unanswered questions, and I'm not so sure that the committee, the way it is leaning, is going to answer some of these unanswered questions. But what stands out to you as something that's probably not getting the attention that maybe it should?
One important thing, you know, considering the misconduct that's been revealed on the part of the Department of Justice and FBI at high levels during the Trump administration against Donald Trump, such as the FBI lawyer who had to plead guilty to doctoring documents to illegally spy on a Trump associate, people have not asked what was the involvement of these undercover agents. We know there were some in the crowd on January 6th in the Capitol. How many agents were there? They won't say. What was their role? Was there any potential misconduct? Was there a plan to infiltrate this crowd toward a particular end? And it certainly wouldn't be the first time
that undercover federal agents or their operatives have gone into a crowd with some kind of a mission or a secretive mission that we don't know about. And I certainly think at this point we deserve answers to those questions. But again, the press is not asking those kind of questions, or they're certainly, if being asked, not going to be able to get those kinds of answers because of the way these investigations are being run.
And again, you go into a lot of detail at CherylAtkison.com. You have an interesting cover story tomorrow morning on Full Measure, ABC 7 at 10 o'clock, and that is the corruption in Puerto Rico. And I don't think people realize the magnitude over the years of corruption there.
I didn't either before I'd spent quite a bit of time there. I've made many trips to Puerto Rico. I love it. And in fact, I encourage people to visit this beautiful island. It's a U.S. territory. It's easy to get to. You don't need a passport. They're friendly. It's just a wonderful place. But, of course, like every place, it has its flaws. And as it happens, the Puerto Ricans themselves will tell you that this government they have is legendary for its corruption. And that turns out to be the case. It comes into play every time there's a major disaster and we send taxpayer money that way. Of course we want to help the people. And then we find out that their leaders or some of their leaders have taken the money and run with it. There are police on the take in huge numbers. So Sunday on Full Measure, I got really good access with some of the FBI teams that are devoted to covering public corruption cases there. In fact, the biggest cases in the United States FBI history of public corruption have all happened in Puerto Rico. I'm going to go over some of the cases and what they're doing about it and what's so unique about this island that makes it rife for that kind of crime.
That's tomorrow morning, ABC 7, 10 o'clock. Cheryl Atkinson and Full Measure. As always, Cheryl, thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
And you too. And do check out Cheryl's blog post at CherylAtkison.com on January 6th. It is now 7:27, Saturday Morning Update. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer is next. We're going to get his read on the January 6th investigation. And then Dr. Bob Lajeda will join us as K.T. McFarland is traveling this weekend. And we'll get a look at the new Omicron variant. Do stay with us on the Saturday Morning Update.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. The one radio station for you to depend on. All day, every day. 105.9 FM, WMAL. A Cumulus Media station. News now.
WMAL News at 7:30. Good morning, I'm Heather Curtis. The body of a missing D.C. woman is one of two found in a shopping cart in the woods in Alexandria last month. DNA led to the positive ID of 29-year-old Cheyenne Brown and 48-year-old Stephanie Harrison of Redding, California. The primary suspect is the alleged shopping cart killer, 35-year-old Anthony Eugene Brown.
Cheyenne interacted with Robinson on the Plenty of Fish dating app. It is believed that Robinson used the Plenty of Fish dating app to lure his victims.
Fairfax County Police Chief Kevin Davis says Robinson's in jail in Rockingham County, awaiting trial for the murders of two other women in Harrisonburg. Schools in Montgomery County will no longer be closing automatically if 5% of employees and students test positive for COVID. Superintendent Dr. Monifa McKnight says they'll instead look at each school individually. Montgomery County Education Association President Jennifer Martin says school officials haven't given any details about when buildings would close.
Fear and anger are on the rise as people question what is the plan.
A 15-year-old is charged with murder as an adult after telling Prince George's County Police he killed two family members. An 8-year-old boy and 44-year-old woman were found shot to death at a home in Clinton. Another relative was shot and has non-life-threatening injuries. WMAL Sports, the Wizards lost to the Bulls. The Caps fell to the Blues. Traffic and weather next. WMAL traffic. Here's Albie D in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
In Maryland, traveling between the two beltways on the BW Parkway in Laurel, you're going to find a crash northbound right at 198. No reports of any slowdowns on the southbound side of the BW Parkway between the DC Beltway and the Baltimore Beltway. Same thing on 95. All lanes are clear northbound and southbound. In Montgomery County on 270 between the Beltway and Frederick, no delays on the northbound side and on the southbound side. In the Maryland side of the Beltway from Prince George's County through Montgomery County, you're not going to hit your brakes on the inner loop or on the outer loop. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Today, sunny, high temps in the lower 30s. Tonight, cloudy, low temps in the lower 30s. Right now, It is 24 chilly degrees in Washington. I'm Heather Curtis on 105.9 FM, Washington's Mall, WMAL.
7:35, it's the Saturday morning update, a chilly January morning. I'm Rick Fowler. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer joins us. He is the president of the London Center for Policy Research. He has also authored Operation Dark Heart. Tony, great to have you with us this morning.
Hey, Rick, always great to join you, even on a cold morning.
Yeah, well, a lot of talk this week, obviously, about January 6th, and there's this huge investigation that Democrats will be drawing out as long as they possibly can. You know, it is funny. I played this clip earlier where President Biden was asked whether his, you know, remarks were divisive earlier in the week. And the final thing he said when he was responding to reporters after his statement, he said, we need to move on. Well, they're doing that. That's far from moving on in the U.S. Congress. So I wanted to go into some of the questions that are floating around out there. I'm not sure we're going to get clear answers from the partisan committee members when their investigation is done. And one of them is this question about Ray Epps. And
yeah,
he is a Marine veteran. He was seen in a video urging a group of Trump supporters to go into the Capitol. But he's home on the ranch in Arizona. What do we know about this guy?
So this is goes back to the question by multiple members of conservative congressmen asking Attorney General Merrick Garland how many federal officers or informants were involved in the 6th January effort, and he refused to answer during testimony. And Ray Epps is simply, I think, the most obvious by the fact that there's multiple videos of him calling for the siege to the Capitol. Even on the video, he says, I'm probably going to get arrested for this. And people are asking, why isn't he? Because he did incite whatever you want to call the 6th of January. He clearly was one of those inciting the events. So the question becomes, why is he not in custody? It's a very simple question, and nobody seems willing to address it. So as long as that's out there, Rick, people are going to ask that question because it's obvious. It's too obvious to ignore. And I think until we get to the bottom of people like Ray Epps and others being there, you're never going to have a complete story. And I'm one of those who believes that obviously, as a whistleblower, you got to follow the facts wherever they go, not where you want them to go. And I think that's something that clearly, if the Republicans come back in, they've got to investigate.
Well, is anybody looking into the possibility that there could be some folks who were actually from the other side? I mean, you know, kind of on the left-hand side of things that were actually in there, you know, stirring things up. I mean, there was a BLM activist, reportedly BLM activist, who was there shooting video, not necessarily that.
Right.
Not necessarily that he did anything to incite anything, but, you know, I don't see him as a huge Trump supporter. He was there to document, and you know, what other people could have been in there that, you know, were plants, so to speak, as you mentioned?
Well, there was events prior to this where people from BLM and Antifa stand up, went to Trump events. There's no reason to think this was some exception that they didn't show up at. So I'm one of those, again, who believes that the guy you mentioned, he was observed inside the Capitol, made a lot of money off of doing it. There were others who were observed. Their pictures were linked to their arrest pictures, prior arrest pictures in Portland and other places. So, again, I don't think they showed up all of a sudden out of the blue to support Trump. So it is something that's out there. And again, if you're going to investigate it, you've got to investigate everything. Right now, as many Americans see it, it's a complete charade.
You've been involved in these types of hearings on Capitol Hill.
Right.
As you look at this committee, Liz Cheney is a Republican on there. Jim Jordan, they kicked him off, and there were others, I think, the Republicans that were removed from the committee. What kind of a finding are we going to get from a very partisan investigation?
The objective of the committee is not fact-finding. It's to find a path to prevent Donald Trump from ever running for office again. That's it. That's all they're trying to do. There's nothing else. So,
unbelievable. Interesting series in Newsweek that you pointed out to me. And tell us a little bit about this Special Operations Force, the hostage rescue team that was in at the Capitol.
Yeah, there's that article in Newsweek is about 60% accurate. And I don't want to get into the pieces which are actually accurate, so I don't want to give up anything regarding capacity. There is typically, Rick, always a special operations team within very short access whenever national leaders, the vice president or president, are moving around and doing things. In this case, the team was actually in the Ford office building, Ford House office building. People who are familiar with this, one is a reporter. And that team, whatever you want to call it, was there and available. So to me, the big question, it's not the question that this team exists and they do things with it. This is something that is always available, kind of a fail-safe. If everything else fails, you've got this last effort, this last-ditch effort team. They never used it, never came close to using it. And you got to ask, why was the National Guard request by President Trump turned down? Why were these guys never used to restore order? And again, this circles back to the original question regarding what is the 6th January committee trying to do if they're not actually trying to investigate things like this. And by the way, Rick, Newsweek is not a conservative publication. So this is not something that conservative circles are trying to drum up. This is something I know to be true, but they're not investigating it. And it clearly, the reason to not use that force goes back to Nancy Pelosi.
Well, an article quotes former Capitol Police Chief Stephen Sund, an article that was in the Washington Post, said he had made a request prior to the January 6th riot to be allowed to ask to have D.C. National Guard on standby in the event they may be needed. But he alleged that House and Senate security officials either rejected or offered a different alternative to his request. And who is on top of the House and Senate security officials, especially on the House side? Who's in charge?
Nancy Pelosi, yeah. And that's the issue, is that it appears, if just by looking at the facts, that there was a failure of authority and leadership based on they knew that something could be going wrong, and they refused at every step of the way to bring in the proper resources. So, again, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that something is really wrong with that day from the response aspect. And, Rick, you and I have been to the Capitol. When have you ever seen anybody, especially during a high-tension time, get close to the building? They don't allow it. And the moment you get close, they normally reinforce. So they knew this was a possibility, they being Nancy Pelosi, and they let it happen anyway. So, again, this is not a fair investigation of what happened on the 6th of January.
All right, so we've had the reports of 175,000 Russian troops building up at the Ukraine border.
Yeah.
Article in Yahoo News, add Kazakhstan to the list of former Soviet republics whose independence is now being threatened by Russia. Russian leader Vladimir Putin using a similar playbook there to the one that he has used over almost a decade to threaten the sovereignty of Ukraine. So it's multiple fronts now.
And this is just further evidence of Putin's desire to reestablish all the stands, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, as buffers to the larger Russian Republic. Again, you know, Rick, people have observed this, but they don't seem to internalize it. Putin has said he wants to reestablish the prestige and power of the old Soviet Union. That's what he's doing. And the stands are a very key component of that. You know, you combine that then with Ukraine, which is another buffer state he wants to take. This is all within what we know he's going to do. And what's ironic here, I know we didn't cover this, I didn't include this in my notes, I got this from one of my colleagues last night. One of the things that the Biden administration's offering to do to counter this, they're offering this, Rick, is that we'll cut our troops. We're going to cut our troops if you cut your troops. That's what Biden's going to offer over the next few days when they go and start talking. Yeah, it's like that's going to be a real solution to standing up to a strong man. Yeah, we'll cut our troops. You got to cut yours too, but we'll cut ours. So this is more evidence that we have a president and a national security apparatus that's completely out of touch. I don't know who's listening today. I know they do listen to us. You people are morons. This is dangerous brinksmanship, where you have the high school debating team in charge and have no clue on how to work to counter Putin. It's a very dangerous thing.
How should they reach you? What's the best way to reach you for those folks that need some help?
Well, LondonCenter.org, you know, they can go right through the website to us. Obviously, we just did a thought to action on this. You know, we do our thought to action podcast. We have our 2022. We're not 2020 as the president said. We're 2022 podcast, where we go through all these issues, really deep dive on what we just talking about regarding Putin, Russia, the stands, and Ukraine. So I think people will learn a lot if they tune into Thought to Action. So.
All right, you folks, Tony knows his stuff. You should call him and talk it out. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, London Center. Thank you so much, Tony.
Thanks, Rick.
All right, coming up next, we talked to Dr. Bob Lahida last night, and we played a little bit of the conversation earlier. We have a lot more information coming up for you next about the new mutation on the coronavirus. That's next, but first, Al BD's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
On the Virginia side of the Beltway, after checking out the traffic cameras, I want to let you know there isn't any construction or any crashes to slow you down, both on the inner loop or on the outer loop. In Fairfax County on 66, all lanes are clear and at speed, northbound and southbound. On 95 between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, on the southbound side of 95 in Woodbridge, you're going to find slow traffic between 123 and the Prince William Parkway. And in D.C., 295, 395, and 695, all lanes are clear there. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Sunny skies and cold temperatures expected on this Saturday. Highs should reach the lower 30s. As we head overnight, partly cloudy, lows back into the 20s in the suburbs, lower 30s around town. For your Sunday, an area of low pressure. With the cold air, we will have the chance for some freezing rain. In fact, a winter weather advisory is in effect from 6 o'clock in the morning through noon, areas north and west of D.C. We will see temperatures moderate through the afternoon into the low and mid-40s. Time 7 News meteorologist Alex Lee at the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
20 degrees in the nation's capital, 747 on WMAL. It's the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler, and with all of the confusion that we have seen in and around the coronavirus, the Omicron variant, media reports, reports out of the White House, a lot of confusion, and we always turn to somebody that can really help. It's Dr. Bob Lahida, and he is the director of the St. Joseph Institute for Autoimmune and Rheumatic Disease. He is also a professor of medicine at the Hackensack Meridian School of Medicine, and he has just authored the book, Immunity Strong, Boost Your Natural Healing Power and Live to 100. Dr. Lahida, thanks for coming back with us.
Thanks, Rick. It's a pleasure to be with you.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the Omicron variant. And now there is a new mutation also being discussed?
Yeah, this is a variant that comes out of France. It's actually, I saw it 3 days ago, and I knew it as the Cameroon variant, but is now in France, and it's called the IHU variant. We don't know much about it. We just know there are 46 mutations in this virus and 12 gene deletions. And there's, I think, reading the paper, there seem to be two major mutations that affect the spike protein. So I don't think it's of great concern at this time, but it just illustrates the fact that there are always new variants popping up all over the world. And we hope that there will not be one that will push the Omicron variant out, because right now the Omicron variant seems to have little clinical danger for those who get it, except if you have comorbidities. And those you, we all know as lung disease, heart disease, diabetes, severe asthma, and immunosuppressive disorders, cancer therapy, et cetera. So I think the Omicron is currently about 95 to 98% of our infections in this country. The IHU variant has been seen in this country. I can't tell you where at this time, but it's the Cameroon variant, and we're just watching it.
Well, I know the Omicron variant is fairly recent. Any indication if people may have the long-haul symptoms as they did with the earlier COVID-19, or is it just too early to tell?
It's just too early to tell. You know, I heard about the Omicron variant on Black Friday, which was the Friday after Thanksgiving. And right now, it's just too soon to tell because people are recovering fairly well from the Omicron illness. And there are millions of people that are affected by that variant. And frankly, I have not seen any long-haul patients that have had the Omicron at this time. But that doesn't say that there may be some in the near future. It's just that we have not seen it, at least reported to us. And I question everyone that comes in whether they've been tested for Delta or Omicron, those who are sick. And all of them that I see right now are all post-Delta infections.
With the rapid spread and the high transmissibility of the Omicron variant, but the less severe reaction that people are having, does that ultimately help to effectuate herd immunity, or is it because of the variant, it may not get to that goal?
Well, you know, we talked about this in the past, that herd immunity, which is about 80 to 90% or immune response, 80 to 90% here in this country. We want to see either vaccination, which is the preferable route to go, or infection, preferably with the Omicron variant, if you're going to pick one. But we're still having people dying in the ICU of everything from the flu to the Delta variant of the COVID virus. I would say that neutralizing antibody over 14 days for Omicron is 14-fold high. And with regard to the Delta variant, if you've been infected with the Omicron variant, you have a 4.4-fold increase of immune reactivity or neutralizing antibody for the Delta variant. So it looks like the Omicron has pushed the Delta variant out. And I think that is good news for everybody. And if I had to predict, if nothing new pops up, any new significant variant, we should be out of this mess by the mid to late part of 2022. I'm keeping my fingers and toes crossed for that.
You mentioned some statistics there, and when you look at boosters, what is the impact that boosters have in staving off the Omicron variant?
Well, the booster vaccination is really terrific for the Omicron variant. You know, if you've only had two doses of either Moderna or Pfizer, you have a 10% protection against the Omicron variant. If you get a booster, that goes up to 75%. And at weeks 5 to 9, that begins to wane. It gets to be about 55 to 70%. And 10 weeks out after the shot, it's about 40 to 50%. And that's the kind of protection we talk about for influenza when you get the flu shot. So it's really good to get the booster. In fact, I recommend all of my patients to get the booster. And now, as you know, Rick, they're talking about a fourth shot. I don't know how that's going right now or whether that's realistic, but in certain countries like France, Italy, and Israel, they are talking about the boosters for not only adults, but also 12 to 15-year-olds, which is the same for this country. For those countries, we're talking about the second booster. For this country, we're talking about 12 to 15-year-olds just recently approved by the CDC to get the booster, which is also good news. You know, there's about maybe 1.8 to 2 million 12 to 15-year-olds who are positive for the virus. That's not saying they're sick. The ones who are sick are the children that have comorbidities like obesity, which is a big one, and lung diseases, and some rare cardiac cardiomyopathies, diseases of the heart, and so on. So this is good news for the booster. I'm not so sure we all need a fourth shot. That's currently being debated, I guess, by the CDC and some of our epidemiologic experts right now. But suffice it to say, the booster does boost your immunity as it's supposed to, and that's good news.
And what advice would you give parents? We saw the controversy in Chicago with the teachers' union this week. What do you say to parents?
I say to parents, let's get the kids in school and keep them in school. I don't think, and, you know, here in New York City where I am, the new mayor is making sure that children stay in school, and he's following the science. The children need to be in school. The teachers need to be vaccinated and boosted. As a matter of fact, everybody in the school needs to be vaccinated and boosted. I mean, people that are adults, like cafeteria workers, janitors, ancillary staff, secretaries, they should all be vaccinated and boosted. And the kids should be back in school because children have a tough time learning at home. I mean, kids that have Wi-Fi access and stuff, they may be able to learn, but even those children, I'm hearing, are not having a great time by themselves trying to learn at home on a computer. So kids need to be in school and have live teaching. So I don't think Chicago is a good idea. Keeping kids out of school is probably not the way to go.
I want to congratulate you on the success of Immunity Strong. Your book is one of the bestsellers at Amazon.com this week.
So, that's a surprise, Rick.
Well, it doesn't surprise me because of the type of information that you've been providing to us throughout the entire COVID-19 situation over the past year or two. Immunity Strong obviously brings up the question, how much of a role does a strong immune system play against the Omicron variant?
Well, the immune system is critical to not only the variants, but also for any infection, to keeping you well. The immune system is tangible, measurable, lives within our body and determines how long we live and our well-being throughout all of our lives. I talk about that in plain speak in this book. It's the immune system. I call it the biological soul, by the way. And that was not me. That was my wife who made that designation. She's an artist. And she said, you know, the immune system is so pervasive and involves so much and is, you know, the immune system has a hand in everything from atherosclerosis to dementia to all sorts of illnesses that we suffer. And this soul permeates every organ of the body, and it's affected. It's physical. It's complex, too complex, actually, for the layperson to understand the nuances. But in the book, I talk about it in plain speech. I've had multiple people read it, my editors would call me and say, I don't understand this, and I would rewrite it and rewrite it. And I say, as I said, it's affected by stress, by diet, by overall health. The biological soul, which is not immortal, it tries to keep you alive forever, and it's doing that in many cases. It's not like the spiritual soul. Even if you're a-religious, everybody knows there's such a thing as spirituality. That goes on, presumably, after death. And I'm not a theologian or anything, but I'm talking about complex, solid, tangible immune system, which if it's healthy, you know, you will do very, very well. Because if you keep yourself together and you understand how the immune system works and you watch what you do, watch what you drink, don't want to drink too much alcohol, certainly don't want to smoke cigarettes, and probably most important right now during the pandemic, get the vax, get the jab. And it's explained in the book, and it makes a lot of sense. A lot of people are hesitant because they're frightened. They're afraid of new technology. That's nothing new. People were afraid of the light bulb when it was discovered by Thomas Edison. But that doesn't mean that right now the beautiful vaccines that we have that are so effective are dangerous. They do have side effects, some of them, but that's good because that, as I say in my book, that means that your immune system is working. That means you're affecting a very good response, which is something that we're looking for after you get vaccinated. So, you know, people that are unvaccinated make up most of our ICU, and most of the people who are unvaccinated, unfortunately, are those that succumb to this virus.
Dr. Bob Lahida, author of Immunity Strong, Boost Your Natural Healing Power and Live to 100, thank you for giving us yet another perspective on things that we just may not realize about ourselves.
That's right. Thank you. Thank you for asking me about that because it is very, very important. And that's why I wrote the book, to try to explain things to the regular person, not my colleagues, not my medical students or any of the other professors that I deal with.
Dr. Bob Lahida, thank you again.
Thanks, Rick. It's been a pleasure.
Our pleasure. Well, that is it for the Saturday morning update. Thank you very much for being with us. Heather Curtis has got the 8 o'clock news coming up, and then it's Garden Sense right here on WMAL.
All facts.
So much to get to today.
And no filler.
A very busy news day.
Get breaking news and the inside story with Vince Colonnade.
It's so nuts from start to finish.
3 to 6 p.m.
Right here on WMAL.
Where Washington comes to talk. WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. The one radio station for you to depend on. All day, every day. 105.9 FM, WMAL. A Cumulus Media Station. News now.